Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the final concert of the Livermore Amador Symphony in our golden anniversary season. We are very excited about this presentation tonight. It has been a wonderful season. We've done all kinds of beautiful things. So I have a question for you. I'm going to start off tonight's talk with a question. How many of you are excited that you are about to hear the greatest piece of music ever written? Now that's what I wanted to hear. You know, it's hard to make that kind of judgment because, of course, you know, what is the greatest piece of music? How can you make such a subjective claim? But I hope in this short talk that I can at least make a valid claim for that title. Beethoven, of course, was a monument in all of music history. Everyone looked forward to him, and they didn't know it. Certainly everyone looks backwards to him, and they certainly know that. The Ninth Symphony stands alone as being the apotheosis of his famous career. And so we're going to play that for you tonight. And you'll recall we started off our anniversary season earlier this year with Brahms's First. And if you were there for the pre-concert talk, I told you the story about how that was referred to as Beethoven's 10th symphony. And the comparison is interesting because the people at the time, the critics at the time, didn't compare Brahms's worthy contribution to the symphonic literature as Mozart's 42nd symphony or Haydn's 105th. It was, the comparison was to Beethoven. And this was, of course, because they knew that Beethoven was the goal to be reached. He was the figure to be surpassed. And in fact, even after the premiere of the Ninth Symphony in 1824, it's as if the entire musical world took a collective breath because they knew that this was such a powerful work and it was such a monumental work that it would not be soon surpassed. And of course, history shows this in that Brahms's First, if that was the worthy successor, didn't actually premiere until over 50 years after Beethoven's Ninth. Now, of course, this is not to say that there weren't other people who were writing great symphonic music at this time. Certainly Schubert was writing beautiful stuff, Mendelssohn was writing beautiful music. But it was understood by the musical community that Beethoven was the towering figure that had to be achieved and surpassed, if possible. And in fact, there are some people who have suggested that Mahler wrote 10 symphonies, if only so that he could surpass Beethoven, at least in number, if not in quality. And that's not a knock on Mahler, just understand that. But it shows you that there's a long shadow that is cast by Ludwig von Beethoven. So there's a challenge that always happens when you're evaluating a monumental figure such as Beethoven. You're trying to separate all the mythology from the history. And of course, we have two centuries worth of attempts to do exactly that. People have been speculating and rehashing what is actually known for all this time. And so it's a lot of stories have wrapped up around who he was and what he did. I will try to unravel some of that. I will not in any way represent that this is the final word. I am simply yet another voice adding to the rehash. But we do know this, basic biographic data. He was born in Bonn, and his musical talent is recognized early, a lot like Mozart's talent. But it's different than Mozart's talent. Mozart was composing at a very early age, and he was writing concerti at age 6, sonatas at age 4. Beethoven is not composing that early. He's certainly performing that early, but he doesn't actually sit down to write full-length pieces of music until his late teens. But his father does supervise his career and his education, and his father tries to have the same kind of success that Mozart's father had by parading him through the concert halls of Europe. And so that is met with some success, but Beethoven breaks from this as quickly as he can, and he moves to Vienna. It is his desire to study with Mozart, who at this point in time is an old man. It's not clear historically, we don't know whether they ever met each other, but we do know that Beethoven did study with Haydn, We know that that was a short relationship, and it was also a particularly stormy one. It lasted for less than 6 months in 1793. And after that, they parted ways, and by then, Beethoven was becoming established as a musical presence in Vienna. So he starts to lose his hearing in around 1800. This is around the time of the First Symphony. First and Second Symphonies are written around then. And it's suggested that this could have been the result of anything. It could have been typhus, it could have been some other organic problem. There was one scholar that I read who suggested that it was the result of his habit of immersing his head in water to keep himself awake so that he could write more. And I'm not sure I fall for that. Certainly makes an interesting story. It's part of the mythology that we have to break. But in any case, it's at this time that the entire structure of the symphony itself is about to undergo a change. And this is something that Beethoven does. And scholars conveniently divide his career into three parts. Obviously, it would be the early, middle, and late portions of his career. Certainly makes sense. It's at the beginning of the middle portion where he writes Eroica. This is in 1804, the Third Symphony. And of course, many of you probably have heard the story. He writes this in honor of Napoleon. And Napoleon is perceived at that time as being the great unifier of Europe. What he's going to do militarily is going to be eclipsed by what he'll do diplomatically. But of course, nothing of the kind actually happens. Napoleon, of course, has very grand desires of his own, very imperial attitudes, which, of course, he goes on to substantiate. And so Beethoven actually takes his original copy of the Third Symphony and scratches out Napoleon's name so violently that he tears a hole in the manuscript. He's absolutely furious that Napoleon has done this thing, and he rededicates it to one of his patrons. It's during this middle period, then, that Beethoven winds up writing a lot of the great pieces that we're familiar with, which includes the Third through the Eighth Symphonies. This is the period from about 1804 to roughly 1814, 1815. He writes the Third through the Eighth Symphonies. He writes the Appassionata, piano sonata, beautiful piece. He writes Fidelio, the violin concerto. He writes Christ on the Mount of Olives. And at this point, he becomes quite successful in Vienna. He actually makes quite a living at both performing and conducting, as well as composition. But of course, he is battling the issue of rising deafness. And this eventually claims his hearing completely, even before he writes the Eighth Symphony. He's actually completely deaf by about 1815. And in fact, in 1809, when Napoleon was bombarding Vienna, Beethoven actually is known to have cowered in his basement, covering his head with pillows. He's trying to protect what little hearing he has left. So 1811 is his last performance, and it's his fifth piano concerto that he does. And at this point, he's completely deaf. His health is declining. He gives up performing and conducting, and he concentrates writing exclusively. And this, of course, then marks the late period, which includes the Ninth, which we'll hear tonight. It also includes the Missa Solemnis and a number of his late quartets. And the music that comes out of this period is marked for its incredible extravagance and its invention. He is taking the symphonic form, and he is greatly extending it. He is adding instruments to it. He is adding length to it. He is raising its visibility as a musical form. The symphony in the hands of Mozart was still something that you would listen to in the chamber. It was kind of effectively grew out of chamber music. But in Beethoven's hands, it becomes the thing that you drop everything to witness. The symphony is the be-all and the end-all of music, and Beethoven is the one who makes it so. So all of these things are happening. We also know biographically that Beethoven never marries. He is possibly devoted to his craft. That's one of the mythologies that we hear. But it's actually more complicated. He spends a lot of time with the Brunsvik family. They are one of his patrons. And through them, he meets a countess by the name of Giulietta Giucicardi, which we will fondly refer to as Julie. And he writes a letter to Julie in 1801. We have this letter. And he proposes a marriage to her. But this cannot happen. She is nobility, and he is not. The early 19th century is still bedeviled by classist issues all throughout society. The daughter of this same patron, Josephine Brunsvik, also receives his attention, and he writes her at least 15 very passionate letters between 1804 and 1810. And we know from her response to these letters that she reciprocates his interest. But again, her family says this cannot happen. They withdraw his ability to see her, and he is heartbroken for the second time. But he does actually dedicate to Josephine. He dedicates the Moonlight Sonata, which you're familiar with. And he may also have proposed to Thérèse Malfatti, who is possibly the one to whom he dedicated Fur Elise. Now, the thought that you may have is, well, wait a second, if it's called Fur Elise, why would he dedicate it to Therese? Well, the story there is that it could have been his handwriting, which was quite lousy, or it could have been the result of an illiterate copyist. There are lots of theories on this, and certainly many opinions. And then there's also the what's called the Immortal Beloved letter, and many of you probably saw that movie. It's an attempt to identify the identity of the unnamed person, the woman who is mentioned in this letter. And of course, again, we have lots of theory and lots of speculation. No one really knows. So Beethoven himself is creating this aura of incredible surprise. Everyone knows that he is a composer of landmark status. And this is happening even before he gets to the Ninth Symphony. But it's during all of this time that a lot of the legends that we've all heard about him start to come to pass, or at least have their formations during his history. So, for example, there is the image that we all have that Beethoven was a boorish person, and he was an angry loner, and he had no friends. This is not true. He actually had a devoted circle of friends throughout his entire life. And many of them came to his aid late in life when his health was declining and he could no longer hear anything. We're told that his father beat him whenever he was at the piano and he played a wrong note. Well, we do know that his father was alcoholic and was quite obnoxious, but there's no record of that kind of abuse. He doesn't mention it in any of his letters, and in any of the paperwork that survives, there's no mention of that. It's probably an exaggerated story. But the one idea, another mythology, may actually be true, which is that he is the image of the selfless but tortured genius. You've all heard this. You know, he would go away for months at a time and write beautiful music and come back and impress the world. And there's probably some truth to this, because in 1802, he wrote what was called the Heiligenstadt Testament. This was after the town that he was living in outside of Vienna. And it's in this letter, which we still have, that he expresses his desire to commit suicide. And he also says that he will not do this because he is living for his art and he is living through his art. And so this, of course, doesn't come to light until after Beethoven's death. I'm not sure who he wrote the letter to, but it was a personal testament of a lot of the difficulties that he faced. And so that has come to color the picture of who Beethoven was. And then there's also the image of the anarchist. And this, of course, is one that we know is, in fact, true. Beethoven had a great disdain for authority and for social rank. And in fact, he would often stop performing if an audience made too much sound. Which reminds me, if anybody has a cell phone, now's a good time to turn it off. He also would not perform on demand, like Mozart did. It would be the case that as you played a salon or a personal private concert, a chamber concert, that people would call out songs. And if you were the performer, it was expected that you would actually play these things. This is still true if you go to a house concert. But Beethoven refused to do that. He says, no, I'm going to play only the music that I want to play. I've already played it. And he would be very strict about that. And in fact, one of his patrons, the Archduke Rudolf, there's a cell phone right there. The Archduke Rudolf decreed that the usual court rules of etiquette did not apply when Beethoven was in the house. And this, of course, again, when you look at 19th century, late 18th century European society, there were very strict distinctions, not just in class, but in behavior. So if you were members of opposing or differing classes, there were certain forms of attitude and behavior that you had to acknowledge. So for example, if you were a commoner and a member of the nobility, even if it was a distant relative, came to pass, you would have to curtsy, or you'd have to bow, or you'd have to do these things. Beethoven refused to do all of that. And this is why the Archduke said, look, you know, I'll put up with it, because his talent is worth it. So, and then there's also the image of the brilliant but doomed crazy artist. You hear about this one a lot. And it's been suggested that he was bipolar because he apparently was quite mercurial in his personalities. My own thought on that is that people who make those kinds of suggestions, you know, there's really no way to prove it. And it really says more about the historian than it says about the subject. And then, of course, there's the image also of the idea that Beethoven is himself greater than the destiny that is about him, greater than the world that is around him. And one thing that we do know is that on the night of his funeral, in March of 1827, there was a tremendous electrical storm over Vienna. And, you know, flashes of lightning and peals of thunder and sheets of rain. And 40,000 people attended his funeral, which is pretty impressive since the population of Vienna at the time was only 10,000. But people looked at this incredible thing that was happening, and they were absolutely sure that the gods were furious because this great man had passed into history. So that went a long way to establishing the credentials of Beethoven. All right, so well, what about the music? Well, tonight we start with the Coriolan Overture. This comes from his middle period. And it's actually written after Heinrich Joseph von Collins' tragedy, not the similarly titled tragedy of Shakespearean authorship, although the stories are quite similar. But as with all opera overtures, or as with all overtures that are thematic, what Beethoven is doing is he is telling you an entire story in a 10-minute piece, or a 12-minute piece, or however long it is. And what this means is you are basically, when you're writing an overture, you are advertising all of your thematic material in some portion of the music that you are about to hear. And so that means that in this particular case, Coriolanus, ancient Rome, he has rousted an army that is going to take Rome. And right before he invades the city, his mother prevails upon him and says, "Do not do this, you must be peaceful." So Beethoven starts off with powerful C major chords, and it's all very militaristic and urgent sounding, and then suddenly he breaks to E flat major, which of course is the voice of Coriolanus' mother. Beethoven wrote a lot of overtures. They were very popular in his lifetime. And towards the end of all of these periods, people would come and listen to Beethoven's music, no matter what it was, and no matter who was conducting it, because his popularity had exceeded his breadth, even in his lifetime. So that other people would ask him for the rights to perform his music, and sometimes he would grant them. So this brings us now to the Ninth Symphony. And the Ninth Symphony I was trying to write all of this without using a lot of superlatives. I failed. because it really is a monumental piece. It really may be the greatest piece ever written. It certainly has a lot going for it, even if you don't think it's the greatest piece. That's fine. I'm not here to make, you know, a plug for the piece. But it does have a lot of very original authorship to it. Beethoven is doing things in this symphony that he has not done in any previous symphony. It's the first time that a major composer writes a symphony that includes a chorus. This had not been done. There were lots of choral works, and certainly Mozart and Haydn wrote quite a few of those, many composers before them. But this was the first time that a choral movement had actually been interwoven into an instrumental movement. It inherits from the choral fantasy, if you're familiar with that piece. He takes some of the themes of that piece and greatly extends them. He basically used the choral fantasy as a sketchboard for a lot of his later choral works. But of course, in the ninth, everything is much larger, much bigger, much greater. And of course, he takes Friedrich Schiller's poem, The Ode to Joy. This was written in 1785. And we know that Beethoven, from his own notes, actually knew about this poem as early as 1790, approximately. I think it was quite popular in Germany. But Beethoven was captivated with it, and he knew that he wanted to do something with the poem at some point in his life. And so, other things that are new in this symphony, trombones are heard for the first time. Also, there is a good deal more percussion in this symphony than in previous Beethoven symphonies. So, all of these things are being brought to bear. He's introducing new ideas, new orchestration, new modes of thought. And in fact, even in the lyrics, he takes Schiller's poem and he adds to it because he wants to emphasize not just the ode to joy, not just joy, but freedom and other thematic material. He wants to elevate music to a special status that will allow it then to conquer society's ills. Okay? That's an ambitious task. Maybe he's up for it. So the first movement, the Allegro ma non troppo, that is fast but not too fast. That is, the opening theme is based on the simplest of intervals, the perfect fifth. Da da, da da, da 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 da. And he takes this, but he does it with the strings playing a tremolo the whole time. And it has the effect of making you expect something. It brings out a great expectancy. And in fact, it's a lot like the sound that you have when an orchestra itself is tuning up before they play. And in fact, the resemblance between an orchestra tuning and the first movement is so great that a lot of commentators have suggested that that was actually his the source of inspiration for the first. So, but from this tuning limbo that he creates, he then is able to import a theme out of it that then emerges with great power and great clarity, and it then serves to communicate the urgency of the music to the rest of the symphony. And then in the second movement, Beethoven surprises us. It was traditional at the time to have a scherzo be the third movement, and you would have a slow movement as the second. But in the Ninth Symphony, he actually inverts those two, and he makes the second movement become the scherzo. And it's, in fact, much longer than most scherzi generally are. In fact, he actually incorporates fugue elements into the material that he produces, so that the melody that he's got, he doesn't actually do this, but you can actually take the melody and you can stack it bar by bar, you can stagger it, and it still harmonizes with itself, and it still retains the melodic characteristic that it has. The third movement is the slow movement. It is the adagio, molto e cantabile. This is meaning it's a slow piece, and it is designed to be in a singing style. Cantabile means to sing. And it's long, it's very sonorous. And as you listen to this, you can hear that he is emphasizing every note. He wants you to appreciate every aspect of the musical statement that he's making. And in fact, everything that he does is vaguely arpeggiated. Arpeggio means you take a chord and you break it up into pieces, you play them sequentially. He does this a lot in the third movement. And the effect, though, is that he has actually created a new melody out of the existing melody. So when you listen to the third, you'll notice that there are a lot of harmonies that stack upon each other. But contrapuntally, what he's doing is actually creating multiple melodies. And it's a remarkable effect, the way that he does this. Just a quick explanation. The word contrapuntal, that is the adjectival form of the word counterpoint. If you took any music history, music theory, you'll know that harmony is the study of how sounds sound when you play them together, that is to say, vertically on the musical page. Counterpoint, on the other hand, is how notes change and sounds change through time as you play the piece. And so any good composer has a great understanding of both harmony and counterpoint and many other things and is able to weave them all together. And then the fourth movement is perhaps the most amazing. It is a symphony unto itself. Various commentators have observed that, in fact, it's easy to notice, that Beethoven actually reprises many of the melodies and the themes from the earlier movements at the beginning of the fourth movement. And he does this intentionally, because what he's doing is he's saying, here's all this great music. We echo the open fifth theme of the first movement. We echo the scherzo of the second movement. But each time that we do this, and we echo the melodies of the third movement, but each time we do this, we dismiss it with the basses and the celli. And what Beethoven is saying during this is that he's saying, I'm inventing new music. Everything that is happening before this piece is being performed is being erased by this piece. And this is actually echoed in the lyrics that he added to Schiller's poem. And I left the lyrics off of my podium here, but if you look through, you'll notice that the very first line that is sung is, O friends, no longer this sound. And Beethoven is saying this because he wants everyone to know that the musical statement that he's about to make is much broader and grander than anything that he's ever done and than anything that has ever been done before him. And this winds up being the case simply because of the variety that you hear in the fourth movement. So it's in the fourth movement that we have the chorus enter for the first time. We also have the four soloists. You'll notice that we have bleachers back here. There's no football game tonight. But we do have 90 vocalists who are coming in. And we will add those 90 to the 70 orchestra members. You will have a lot of musicians up here on stage. You will be brushed with waves of sound. It's going to be remarkable. I sat out here in the audience on our dress rehearsal the other night, and it was fantastic. What Beethoven continues to do in the fourth movement is, by bits and pieces in the celli and the basses, he introduces the main theme of the Ode to Joy. And bits and pieces through the bass instruments, but also the winds eventually state it as well. And it doesn't finally come through until the baritone actually sings his first solo. And again, the baritone is the lowest voice, just as the basses are the lowest instrument. This is another rejection of tradition. A lot of choral works that went before would always open with a high register vocalist. It would often be a soprano. But Beethoven is breaking with tradition as he does this. And so, of course, the baritone sings, O friends, no more of these sounds, and then he goes into the actual Ode to Joy. And from there, it goes into the Turkish march. Da-da, 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 da-da. And it's called the Turkish march, largely because he was imitating a style that was very popular in those days. The Austrian Empire had battled the Ottoman Turks for centuries, and by the late 18th century, they actually had some success in repelling the Ottoman Turks. One of the things that came out of that was a fusion of musical culture. And the Turkish influence, in fact, was very popular, and Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven all wrote pieces with a lot of Turkish style. And it was through the Turkish influence, largely through their military bands. Their infantry units would always have bands announcing the presence of the army. It was through that drums and cymbals were introduced to the orchestra. They were not much used before that. And then finally, there is a gorgeous development section after the Turkish march, where he weaves all of these themes together in a structure that is a lot like what he does for the second movement. And it's interesting to listen to it because it's in a fast triple time, ta 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 ta. But he plays with your sense of rhythm because he often will emphasize certain notes on beat two of the triplet so that it makes it actually sound like it's in quadruple time. So it would be ta 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 ta. And he does this a lot through the second movement and the fourth movement. It will catch you up, and he does that by design. He wants you to be surprised. He wants to move you from your comfort zone and appreciate the fact that what he's really doing is thumbing his nose at convention. Go back to earlier comments on the anarchist. Okay. And then finally, the fourth movement winds down culminates with the prestissimo. And as you know from your Italian, the word presto is the fastest tempo marking in the orchestra. It means very fast. Allegro means fast. Vivace means faster. And presto is fastest. Well, Beethoven actually writes it not as presto, but prestissimo. Faster still. We want you to play it so fast that you don't even know what fast is. Which is a challenge, by the way, to a lot of symphonies. There has been a lot of study on how people interpret Beethoven's tempo markings. And this is a whole subgenre of music that is mildly interesting, where people actually play the symphonies and the period music with period instruments, in period tunings, in period tempos. And some people have actually suggested that Beethoven's tempo markings were not what he wrote in, and that those had been superseded by later copies. Well, that's not true. We actually have his earliest manuscript. And it also turns out that Beethoven's metronome still exists. And you know, the stuff I find when I'm researching these things, I found out that some musicologists actually timed it just to see, you know, whether it was 60 beats per minute if you dial up 60, and they found that that was the case. So Beethoven really did know what he was doing. There's no question about that. So that's the ninth. And then we get to what happened when it was first performed, which was in May of 1824. And by this time, Beethoven is completely deaf. He cannot hear a thing. He's still writing music. But he insists on conducting the piece. And in fact, a lot of people want him there because he's in failing health. He's not going to last long. But the concertmaster instructs the orchestra to, you know, just put up with the old man. You can watch him, but really watch me, and I'll be giving, you know, the actual conducting. And so the story from eyewitnesses was that he actually would stand at the podium and he was directing the orchestra, and he was still conducting after the last note. Either he had gotten off, or the orchestra had gotten off, not likely, or the tempo marking issue came back up again, although that's hard to imagine that the orchestra finished before the composer did. But that's one of the things that happened. And so he was still conducting, didn't know the symphony was concluded, so the soprano soloist gently goes to him and taps him on the shoulder and says, motions to him to turn around. And he turns around, and the audience is going nuts. They're going crazy. It's just they're standing on their feet. They're jumping up and down. They're cheering. They're throwing handkerchiefs in the air. They're raising their hands. 5 standing ovations. And it is said that Beethoven wept with joy, as you can only imagine he would, to understand that his music has been received so remarkably. So the praise was immediate, his fate was sealed, no question about it. The Allgemeine Musikalische Zeitung says this. This was the review after the concert. It says, "His inexhaustible genius has shown us a new world." And no one counteracted that comment. And Carl Czerny, one of his students, actually was also there, and he said, "The Ninth Symphony breathes such a fresh, lively, indeed youthful spirit. It has so much power, so much innovation and beauty as ever came from the head of this original man, although he certainly sometimes led the old wigs to shake their heads." And I like that because, of course, this is once again Beethoven thumbing his nose at convention. Beethoven dies 3 years later, and then all of this time goes further where there is no worthy contender to the Ninth Symphony. But its impact is widely felt. All of the composers who follow him do everything they can to imitate him without being caught. And in some cases, in the case of Brahms, he actively copied Beethoven, and he said so. He said that, "I know the best music when I hear it. It's no mistake that I will use it." And so, to this day, the Ninth Symphony continues to receive accolades in ways that the composer never would have imagined. It was adopted as the European National Anthem in 1972. And when the European Union formally codified their membership in 1985, it was readopted as the European Anthem. In 1989, Leonard Bernstein conducted a concert at the Brandenburg Gate to celebrate the fall of the Berlin Wall. And Bernstein did something interesting. He changed the words from Freude, which is the German for joy, to Freiheit, which is the German for freedom. So he was turning the Ninth Symphony into a political piece. But he himself said that this actually was what Schiller's original intent was in the 1795 poem. But that the powers that be in 1795 told Schiller that, "No, you can't write a poem that celebrates freedom, certainly not when we have these British colonies in the New World who have just launched their revolution and have separated. And this, of course, is causing trouble in France. There's a revolution there. We can't have." So, of course, he was told to make it something superfluous, something joyous, and that's how the words came. So when Bernstein performed this, he actually was doing Schiller a nod of historical justice. And then there's the story of when Kosovo became a country in 1997. They were a country, a nation, without an anthem. And so they did what any good-thinking nation, fledgling nation would do, which is borrow from the best. And so they too adopted the Ode to Joy as the Kosovo national anthem. And it wasn't until a few years later that some Kosovar wag finally said, "You know, having a national anthem for Kosovo that was written by a German might not actually be politically astute." So they actually found someone to write a Kosovo anthem. In 2002, the original score of the symphony, which is kept in the Berlin Library, was added to the United Nations World Heritage List. It's the only work of music ever to do that. It's won several Grammys over the years by different artists. In fact, more Grammys have been won in the classical music realm on the Ninth than on any other piece. And the Ninth Symphony, I didn't know this until a few days ago, the Ninth Symphony is hugely popular in Japan. And the funny story there is that the Japanese culture learned about Beethoven's Ninth through prisoners, German prisoners in World War I, who actually taught them this piece and made them aware of it. And so by World War II, Imperial Japan is at the helm. They actually actively promoted the playing of Beethoven's Ninth, because in World War II, Germany was an ally of Japan. And what's interesting now is that the piece has become so popular in Japan that they perform it every New Year's Eve, and at least 50 orchestras all throughout the nation will actually perform the entire thing. And it has become this cultural tradition in Japan, where you will go to listen to a performance of the Ninth Symphony on New Year's Eve. And in fact, that tradition has been extended in recent years, wherein they no longer just play the Ninth, they actually play the entire cycle of all nine symphonies. Places where you wouldn't expect people to discover Beethoven, certainly happening. And then one of the funniest stories that I found was that when the Boston Symphony Orchestra was building their new concert hall, they put Beethoven's name on it. And the reason was Beethoven was the only name that all of the board members could agree on. All these names are suggested, and you know, it's like, no, I can't do that, I can't do that. Oh, Beethoven? Yeah, yeah, we can do. And of course, the Ninth Symphony also gave us the standard length of a CD. I don't know if you know that. But when the original compact disc came out in the late 1970s, the head of Sony Music, who had bought all the patents from Philips, was a big Beethoven fan. And so his engineers came to him and said, you know, we've got this new format, we don't know how long we should make it. And his comment was, I don't care how long you make it, just make it long enough to hold Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. True story. And then one final coincidence is that Beethoven's symphony is exactly as long as my commute. It's the most amazing thing. I can actually press play when I leave my house, and then 74 minutes later, I'm coming right to the end of the Prestissimo. It's amazing. I don't know how he did this. He's a genius. So I will close with a quote from Beethoven himself. And this is what he had to say about the symphonic form, which he perfected. And it is this. He said, symphonies are the best representation of my true self. I always seem to hear within me the sounds of a great orchestra. And he was able to write those down for all of us to enjoy. So, before we go to tune, just a few quick announcements. Next year, we will continue our golden anniversary celebrations. We've had a great time this year. We've had lots of public music. We've played at City Hall. We've done all kinds of amazing things. Next year will be the 50th anniversary of Dr. Arthur Barnes as our conductor. And so we are continuing the celebration. We will be playing quite a few original works by his pen. And we will also play Dvorak's Ninth Symphony from the New World. That's a lovely piece. Many of you know it. We'll be playing Tchaikovsky's Fifth. We'll also be playing Howard Hanson's Second Symphony, which is a lovely piece. So buy your season tickets now before you leave tonight. It's going to be a great season. And with that, enjoy the concert.